Hello and welcome to the Untitled Leisure Project. My name is Graham Pira. I will be your temporary host today. Joining me is a grizzled alum of The Voice. Would you like to introduce yourself, Noah?
Hello, I'm Noah Bion, a recent graduate.
Yes, Noah has moved on.
Institution.
Yes, Noah has moved on to bigger and better things, but he has not moved on quite yet because he's still here to podcast with me for his first time.
First time, and I'm happy to be here.
Yes, he has a huge grin on his face. Yeah. In case you can't see right now. So yes, welcome to another episode of the Untitled Leisure Project. Today we are talking about Wonder Woman, and if you live under a rock and have not read anything about the movies, Wonder Woman was released on June 2nd to pretty much universal critical acclaim.
No.
Well, it has a 93% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay, that only aggregates sort of the conventional
I know,
sense.
It's not the most accurate. But compared to the... Okay, let me put it this way. Compared to the other DC Extended Universe movies, it is basically like the Casablanca of... The DC Extended
Universe.
Yes,
I agree wholeheartedly.
Okay. But the good part for Warner Brothers was that it grossed $103 million on its opening weekend, which was the lowest of any movie in the DC Extended Universe, but the highest of any movie ever directed by a female, which is
yes,
good.
And the highest, I believe, comic film starring a female.
Yes. And the other good thing is that its second weekend, it dropped by less than 50%, whereas Batman v. Superman. I guess you have to say V because it's not a versus. It sounds like a Supreme Court case. Like, wouldn't that be a great movie? Like, Batman v. Superman. Anyway, Batman v. Superman dropped by, I think it was 66% its second weekend. Suicide Squad dropped by like 70%, and Man of Steel did the same thing. And a lot of movies this year have dropped very steeply in their second weekend. Wonder Woman did not. I believe it just outpaced the Man of Steel. It'll probably end up around $800 million. Worldwide, that's my guess. So not quite as much as Batman v Superman, but it also cost $100 million less to make. So it's going to be and probably end up more profitable. That all this stuff is some box office mojo, by the way.
Right, but it should be mentioned, I think, that the stakes are a lot higher in the case of
yes.
Wonder Woman.
It was much more important
that Wonder Woman succeeded than... Batman v. Superman yes. succeeded.
Batman v. Superman, the 10-hour Supreme Court legal case. Yes, we will get into that. So, so there's the background. Basically, the movie is about Diana Prince, played by Gal Gadot, which I have come to the conclusion that that is how you pronounce her name.
Because
that's how she pronounces it.
Okay, fair enough.
Because I've heard Gal Gadot, like, yeah. Waiting for Godot, and then Gal Gadot.
But she's not awful. French.
She's not, yeah. No. So Gal Gadot plays Diana Prince, Wonder Woman, who... lives on the island of Themyscira, which is an island in the Atlantic? I don't know. It's the idea is that...
It's sort of like the island in Pirates of the Caribbean that you only know to find if you know where it is.
Yeah. So pretty much the idea is that the Amazons were this race created by Zeus to fight off Ares, the god of war, who was the son of Zeus. And Zeus created this island called Themyscira that was masked from the world of men. Only the Amazons existed there. They're this perfect all-female, all-warrior race. Then one day, Steve Trevor, an American spy who's piloting a plane, crash lands near Themyscira. Diana sees him, finds him, and then the rest of the movie proceeds from there.
Right. It should be noted that...
Are you just going to correct me this whole podcast?
No, I'm not correcting you. I'm just elaborating on your succinct and... compelling retelling.
Thank you.
Which is that Steve Trevor was an American pilot working for the British for some reason during World War One.
During World War
One. I just feel like that.
Yeah, no, that is
chronology.
And we'll get into spoilers. By the way, spoiler warning: if you haven't seen Wonder Woman, go see it.
That's not a big spoiler though. It's set in World War One.
It's also,
by the way, it's arguably the best World War One film to have come out.
So I looked up on Box Office Mojo before this. It's the number one grossing World War One movie of all time. You want to know what's number two?
No, what is it?
War Horse.
Oh God.
Well, it has some pretty steep competition.
Yeah. This is, mind you, the centenary of the Russian Revolution. Yes. 1917 was arguably the most pivotal year of the war. So it's pretty sad that this is the best the world can muster. But
yeah.
In fairness, the film seems to display the grit and horror of the war reasonably faithfully.
And I like, because we've gotten so many World War II movies. But anyway, like we will get into all this. So to start us off, Wonder Woman, your general thoughts.
So I should say a couple of things before I get to my evaluation. I'm not a connoisseur aficionado of superhero movies, period. And I'm not really steeped in the context or history of this particular franchise, even the DC universe writ large. With all that being said, I really enjoyed myself.
So I'm going to go the opposite. I'm a huge DC Comics fan, which is actually good because you don't know that much. You can provide more of an objective thing. I loved this movie, like, without reservation. I really, really enjoyed it. It was easily the best. I thought it was the best superhero movie in general since The Dark Knight. Easily the best DC extended universe movie. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's best compared to Captain America.
Okay, we're gonna...
Which is high praise, I think.
So, everyone is saying that. And I think, the movies do have stuff in common. They're both period pieces. They both involve a man played by an actor named Chris, a character named Steve, flying a plane off to sacrifice himself to save the day.
Chased by Germans.
But I actually think that this takes a lot more from, at least thematically, from the 1978 Superman Richard Donner movie. Superman the movie. The original superhero movie. The first one. I believe it's the first superhero movie ever made.
I'll take your word for it.
Okay. I think that that was the first one. It was the first mainstream superhero hit. But yeah, again, before we get into all the themes and such, I was thinking we'd organize this discussion somehow by talking about various aspects. So the characters. Steve Trevor. Let's start with him. Right, what did you think of Steve Trevor?
Steve Trevor is sort of the superhero's boyfriend, right? He's supposed to be the equivalent of a sidekick, I suppose. Played by Chris Pine, so aesthetically an interesting character.
he's very handsome.
He's a very handsome man. Something that both I and Gal Gadot both seem
to... Just say it's probably the most attractive pairing.
Yes, and their chemistry is seemingly pretty good.
Yeah.
I will say Steve/Chris Pine had a pretty tough mandate here because Steve had to avoid any pretense of being patriarchal, of mansplaining, etc. So I don't think he succeeded as a feminist character, which is what I would have preferred, since I think movies should be political. But I do think that he did a good job supporting Wonder Woman and not being either a co-equal or a dominating force.
Yeah, so what I thought that this movie could have gone really badly if they messed up Steve Trevor. Because I feel like Wonder Woman, they had a really good idea of what they were going to do with her. And Gal Gadot was really good as Wonder Woman. But Steve Trevor, they could have gone either way, where he could be this domineering force who takes over the movie, or he could just be this really weak character. And I thought that they actually walked a really fine line. And Chris Pine was perfect in the role. I thought he gave a really, really good performance. His timing, his comedic timing is impeccable. He had so many great one-liners, and I really liked, like, the fish out of water comedy that happens. Basically, what happens is, when Steve Trevor arrives, Diana saves him, and they eventually end up going back to London, because Diana wants to go to find wherever the war is and stop it.
Right.
So, the whole dynamic is, Diana has no idea how society works, because she's been on Themyscira all of her life.
Right.
While Steve is kind of world weary, and he knows
what's going on. Yes, he's a very savvy operator.
Yeah. So the comedy comes from the fact that Diana is, you know, kind of floating through. I don't really know how to describe the comedy without giving some of the best parts away, but it's very much fish out of water. You've probably seen a lot of the comedy before, but it does it really well. And the chemistry, like, it's very sincere. I never felt at any point like the movie was insulting the audience's intelligence or making us laugh at the characters. I just thought that it did a very good job of building the respect between them and still providing, like, these really funny moments that endear you to the characters.
Yeah, it was sincere. I think if you did a table reading, you would say this is cheesy, but it didn't come across that way when it was acted out.
Yeah. I loved the dressing room scene. I laughed more during the dressing room scene when Diana's trying on the different outfits than I do during most comedies.
Yeah. I do think it was funny, but I have a couple of quibbles with the whole fish out of water shtick that I think they made a lot of hay out of. First, I think it's troublesome because Diana doesn't know how society works, so she's not aware of the status of women during the Edwardian period in England, which is to say, like, could have been worse, could have been a lot better.
Yeah.
I think this is post-suffrage. But,
Wait. Because there's that scene where Edda Candy says the line about, that's how we got the vote or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember if she says, like, that's how we're going to get the vote or, I don't know. Anyway. Well, it's around that time.
Yeah. So, One of my problems was that I think that the film used the fish out of water shtick to kind of make what would have otherwise been like female assertions a little bit cheaper. So, mild spoiler alert: Diana walks into a cabinet meeting because she doesn't realize that it's not a woman's place at that time to be in a cabinet meeting. And so, rather than that being an act of assertion, it's just sort of, she didn't know any better. And of course, she pushes back against the fact that this is a man's room, a man's place, a man's world. But I sort of think that shtick was used to make sort of her feminist assertions a little more palatable to an audience.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that they were... I think so. I think that this whole movie was played very safely because of the whole Sony Ghostbusters fiasco, this is kind of changing the subject away from the movie, but, like, for example, when Sony was marketing the all-female Ghostbusters that was released last year, it was very prominent, the fact that they were four female.
It was leads. Ham-handed.
It was very, they were making that very obvious, and they were sort of, I think a lot of people interpreted it like a political statement, and the movie bombed.
The movie did very badly.
And I think Warner Brothers was terrified of that happening with this movie. So I definitely think that they, if there wasn't necessarily a mandate, there was definitely, they wanted to play it safe, but... And I do agree with you that I feel like the film kind of sort of, like, washed over those scenes. Like, yeah, there was a scene when Diana goes into the cabinet meeting and then everyone leaves. But it's played for laughs more than anything else.
Right.
And then the moments where she asserts herself, there never are really the consequences that probably would have happened in real life back then. Like, they're just kind of, when she says she reveals that she can speak the two languages that the notebook is written in.
Right.
And they're like, let's let her read it. That is, you know, like in the movie, they just move past it. I don't know if in real life it would have been the same thing. But I do think that I understand why the movie made those decisions. And I don't think that it was trying to be a political... I think it was trying to be a superhero movie. It wasn't trying to be this overt political statement. And the question then becomes, did it have to be? Like, by the nature of the fact that it was the first female starring superhero movie since Elektra in 2005, which was horrible, did it then have to be a political statement? And what I want, like, because I don't really have a lot of ethos on the subject, I kind of want to, like, look at it just as a movie, not necessarily as a political statement.
Sure.
But I understand. Sure. So I had no problem with that, but right. I understand the criticisms of it, that it didn't do the best job of representing what a woman really would have gone.
The reason I'm so sensitive to it is that I was sort of in your camp. You know, I was always attuned going into the politics of it, and it was important to me that the movie wasn't an exercise in objectification and so on and so forth. And I thought it was it played it safe, but what it had done was sort of elevated the standard ever so slightly, and that was trending in the right direction.
Yeah.
My girlfriend saw it too, and she hated it because it didn't go far enough for her. And I'm not saying that I speak for all men or that she speaks for all women, but it was very important to her in a way that it wasn't to me that the film had these political elements to it. And so I think we have to acknowledge the fact that it's a movie, it's entertainment, but as a piece of pop culture, it's also an agenda-setting item. And so I don't think we can entirely dismiss the politics of it. That said, okay. I personally agree with your reading of it.
Yeah. And so I think what I was kind of surprised by, and what I really loved about Diana's character, was that the whole movie was about her beliefs and her values and her principles. And I think one of the best scenes in the movie, and sort of this subverting of the whole dynamic between her and Steve Trevor, where Steve Trevor's always telling her what to do,
right,
because she doesn't know what to do,
right,
is right before the no man's land sequence, when they're going through the trenches and you know, they're saying, oh, we have to keep going, like, the next crossing is a day away, we have to get there. And Diana's like, no, the village, like, these people are hurt, we have to help them.
Right.
And Steve Trevor's, like, yelling at her not to, like, we can't do that. And I love the line where he's like, look, we didn't come here to save these people. And Diana's like, I know that's not what we came here to do, but it's what I'm going to do.
Right.
And then that's the moment where, like, she becomes Wonder Woman. And the two times I saw this movie, both times when, like, she turns her head away from the camera and she puts on the head
circlet,
like the hand, yeah, the headband thing. There's got to be a cooler name for that. But she turns and like she reveals her out their outfit, and that's the Wonder Woman outfit. And she gets up, she's the last one, and then she goes across the field. She gets shot at. Like, people went nuts when that happened. People,
right,
were cheering. It's a very much a crowd pleasing moment. It's a great. It sent like shivers. I understand from what I've read and what I've the podcasts I've listened to, people were crying during that moment because it was a very powerful scene. And I just like the fact that her subverting the expectation where she would do what Steve Trevor says is also a reinforcement of her values, because she wants to do the right thing because it's the right thing, and she believes that the right thing is saving the people in the village who are getting gassed by the Germans. And she's going to go do that regardless of what Steve Trevor says.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really, not necessarily, not subtle, but not really obvious that she was asserting her own values and her own beliefs. So that, I thought that was a very powerful moment in the course of the film.
Yeah, and I agree that was sort of the inflection point of the film. And
yeah,
that was the moment where she became a superhero and not just, you know, an attractive fish out,
yeah,
of water.
But it certainly, and I think that, obviously, because there was a female, Patty Jenkins directed the movie. The camera never leers at her.
No, it doesn't.
Never, it does a really good job of showing her, but it doesn't shy away from the fact that she is beautiful. She is,
yeah,
absolutely gorgeous. And, like, I love the line when Steve Trevor takes the glasses and puts them on Diana, and Etta Candy is like, oh, suddenly you put glasses on her and she's not the most beautiful woman in the world. First off, that's a good day at Clark Kent wearing the glasses, disguising him as Superman. But also, it's true. Gal Gadot is a former model. She is absolutely gorgeous.
Right.
So, as a work of feminist empowerment, I can see how it certainly would fall short.
Sure.
And obviously, yeah, we are two men.
Right, right.
So, take clear, that with a grain of salt.
Yeah, a big
take
grain,
that
of salt.
Grain of salt.
A big grain,
yeah,
of salt.
So, I really, really liked that scene, and I loved the relationship. I think that what the film did really well that was difficult for it to pull off was it created two very compelling arcs for Diana and for Steve, and then had those arcs intersect with each other, but they both felt like complete sad. Like, because you have Steve, who's all about the big picture, and Diana, who wants to save everyone she runs into, and then at the end of the film, I love the line when Steve tells her, like, I can save the day, you can save the world. Because that was the moment when he was like, okay, I need to sacrifice myself because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, and thank God,
yeah,
that happened.
Yeah, no, and what annoys me when people compare the ending to Captain America, the First Avenger, was what people forget. Yes, Steve Rogers flies the plane away, but he crashes and he is resurrected 5 minutes later. Steve Trevor actually dies. Well, presumably he dies.
Presumably
it's a superhero,
he dies,
movie. He can always come back in the sequel. But for all intents and purposes for this movie, he dies. And it felt like it had stakes. It felt like that was an actual consequence.
Yeah, and what was great about that was that it put the nail in the coffin of any speculation that Diana was wrapped up in or somehow not discreet from Steve.
Yeah.
Like, these are two separate people. She moves on. She's broken up about it for a bit. She remembers him, but she moves on.
Yeah. And another thing that's of note, I don't know how significant this is, but Steve tells Diana he loves him.
And
she never tells Steve that he loves,
right,
she loves. I mean, I think it's implied that she does, like her reaction.
Sure,
and
it's strongly
so
implied.
Yeah, but it never felt like she was, it felt like the two had a mutual respect that, like, I bought the fact that they could be in love with each other, which I cannot say about any other superhero movie. I bought the fact that they cared deeply for each other and that they were in love. So I think that's what the movie does. That's the biggest strength of the movie to me, is the relationship between the two of them. And I think that's what the movie does really well.
Yeah, I don't know if I was as convinced by the depth of the relationship.
Maybe I'm just a softie.
But they had undeniable on-screen chemistry.
Yeah.
And it was deeply enjoyable to watch.
And Chris Pine just... The above average line was hilarious. He has so many great one-liners in the movie. They play off of each other really well. So I think that
right, but I mean, Gal Gadot is allowed to be dirty just like Chris Pine. She is.
Yeah.
So it cuts both
ways.
It's
definitely, you're never, the jokes are never at the expense of the characters.
Mm-mm.
And what I also like is the movie treats the audience with some, assumes that the audience has some intelligence, which I think is something that's kind of difficult to pull off in a way, because I think a lot of blockbusters tend to assume that they're catering to the lowest denominator.
Right.
And I really like it when a movie has jokes that are both very, very obvious and also some that are more subtle. And
I don't think we should be suggesting that the dialogue was perfect.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. I mean, there were a lot of...
There was a lot of procedural nonsense.
Yeah.
There was a lot of, frankly, useless mise-en-scene
stuff.
There
was some very cheesy, like, the whole only love can truly save us, like, that's pretty cheesy.
Yeah.
It fits in with the theme, but it
served platitudes.
Yeah.
With extra helpings of them. But all in all, the dialogue seemed to come from a reasonably sincere place.
Like,
and it was so well acted.
And it felt like if they had cast someone else as Chris Pine, as Steve Trevor, someone who doesn't have as good timing. Because so many of the jokes rely on Steve Trevor's timing. And Chris Pine just nails it's perfectly timed, but it would be very easy for those jokes to completely miss.
Yeah, but the same can be said of Gal Gadot.
I don't want to take away from
right,
that.
Right, right.
Gal Gadot gives a great performance.
Right.
She embodies Wonder Woman. She is principled. She is very warm. She's loving. And like Rebecca, like she is very fierce at times,
right.
And I think she does a really good job of embodying Wonder Woman.
Right.
So I want to talk about the ending,
sure.
The finale, because this has been, from what I've read, this has been the point of the film where people say they don't like it. They just straight up don't like it. The end fight between her and Ares. Before I lead with anything, what did you think of the finale?
Yeah, I share the popular assessment of it. You know, it certainly wasn't the most memorable part of the movie. I think the sort of apocalyptic fight scene was when it felt most like its middling cohort of superhero movies.
It felt like Zack Snyder stepped in and directed that part.
Right. But there was so much good stuff before it.
Yeah.
That it didn't so much matter. But if they'd put it anywhere else but the end, I think it really could have destroyed or ruined the movie.
Yeah. So, I agree with that. I think that even if you don't like the ending, the movie does so much good stuff beforehand that it doesn't derail it. I didn't love the ending, but I think I liked it a lot more than other people because it still felt very character-driven. And it felt like it was the culmination of Diana's character arc. The only real issue that I had with it was, in terms of the character of Ares, I feel like the movie tried to have it both ways with his character, because the idea is that Diana throughout the whole movie believes that Ares is doing this. If she just kills Ares, everyone will stop fighting because Ares is the god of war and he's the one poisoning man's minds. And then she gets to General Ludendorff, who's played by Danny Houston, in a deliciously villainous role. He chews all of the scenery in sight. There's one point where he cackles evilly to the person, to Dr. Poison, his sidekick, which I loved. Like, I love that over-the-top villain stuff.
Yeah.
So pretty much she kills him, and she believes that he's Ares. And then she looks down, and she realizes no one's stopping. No one is fighting.
Right.
No one has stopped
fighting.
And right there, you're thinking the movie just pulled off something really difficult, because what it's saying is that Diana's beliefs in Ares were wrong.
It's saying that the whole villain they've set up, this is a meditation on the banality of evil and the conflicted nature of man.
You think that for like 2 minutes.
Right.
And then it is revealed that Sir Patrick Morgan, played by David Thewlis, you will probably know him as Remus Lupin.
Played very unconvincingly.
So it turns out that he's Ares, and the idea is that the whole time he's the one negotiating the armistice. So he reveals that he didn't directly do this, but he sort of, like, there's a scene of him, like, literally whispering in people's ears to, the idea is, like, he sort of poked and prodded the war to happen, but it wasn't entirely his doing. And right there, I felt like the movie tried to have it, like, I think the movie either has to do one of two things. It either has to have Ares not exist and it's all man, or it's Ares doing everything. Because the way that the movie sets it up is when Diana kills Ares at the end, everyone immediately stops fighting.
Right.
Now, I don't think the implication is necessarily that they stop fighting because Ares is dead. I think they stop fighting because they just saw two gods fighting each other and the plane is also gone. So there's no reason for them to keep fighting. But I felt like it was like the movie treading this middle ground that was kind of underwhelming, because on one hand it's saying, yes, Ares does exist and he helped cause the war. But on the other hand, man is also, you know, it's also in the nature of man to go to war. So I was kind of, I guess I was unconvinced by that part.
Yeah, because the stakes of so many superhero films are zero sum, right? If you don't defeat the villain, it's all over. The world ends. And so, unsurprisingly, Ares is defeated.
Yeah.
But then Diana still has to have the rest of her long life defending humanity from its own evil self. So clearly the stakes were not ultimate. They were not.
Yeah, no, and I like that about it.
But during the fight and in the build up to the fight, the movie made it seem like this was the ultimate showdown, and it just wasn't. And so, that felt like a bit of a betrayal, because we had been treated fairly as an audience for all of the film up until then, and then it was like, okay, you guys need some cheap stuff now. Some fireworks.
So that was, I think that was the only real stumble of the film, at least thematically. I think that was the only part where the movie really, but at the same time, I really liked the fact that it was a character driven, that it wasn't, if Diana doesn't defeat Ares, the world is going to blow up, or, you know, he's going to destroy the world. It was Diana wants to defeat Ares because Ares will not stop until, because Ares wants Diana to join him and he will not stop. And he wants to bring all of humanity down with him, but he wouldn't do that, like, through this, you know, massive explosion, or, like, a world engine, like in Man of Steel, or that weird beam that shoots into the sky.
Well, but he has put a plane in the air loaded with the World War I equivalent of a nuclear weapon.
But it's not him who does that. It's his, like, prodding the Germans to do that.
Yeah.
And Steve Trevor is the one who saves that, and then Diana. So it's like Steve and Diana work together to defeat Ares. Steve not directly, but Diana very directly. So that's actually why I liked it. Well, because it felt like it culminated the two characters' arcs through the whole movie.
It did.
Thematically it tried to have it both ways, and it just ended up feeling kind of like a cheat.
Yeah. But it wasn't bad for like, intellectual or political reasons. It just was, you know, bad writing, I think.
Yeah, and it felt like a very generic battle in a movie that did not feel generic at all. Like, a movie that felt very fresh and innovative.
Yes.
And I hope that the DC Extended Universe doesn't turn into the thing where, like, every movie has to have a huge CGI battle at the
end. Like all Marvel movies.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think one of the big criticisms of Marvel movies are criticisms that you can make of this movie, that either the villain was underwhelming or, like, the final fight is kind of generic.
Right.
But I actually don't, I really like Ares as a villain in this movie. Even though he doesn't get a lot of screen time, I think the build-up is good. But again, the finale is thematically questionable, I think, in my mind.
Yeah, I think he could have been handled a little more deftly.
Yeah.
Out of all the characters in the film, he was certainly the least dimensional.
Yeah.
Almost as if they were like, oh gosh, for reasons of creating tension, we gotta slot in a character. So he sort of felt slapdash to me.
Yeah.
But again, it should be emphasized, he did not in any way ruin the movie or take away from its achievements.
Yeah. And I also did like the Dr. Poison character.
She was much more interesting.
I thought originally the twist was going to be she was Ares. But I was completely wrong. I must say, I did not see the twist that it was Sir Patrick Morgan coming.
No, I don't think anyone.
Yeah, no, because it was kind of out of left field, but
I'm not sure that's a good thing.
Yeah, I thought if it was Dr. Maru, that would have been maybe a little more subversive. The part that bothered me was when Arius, like, puts on his armor, his Greek armor, you can still see David Thewlis's mustache underneath. Yeah, take him seriously, because David Thewlis isn't, like, he's a mid-50s, late 50s, early 60s British guy. Right. Like, you can't take him seriously as this god of war.
He's very, lanky.
Yeah, like, he's not intimidating.
He looks a little like Nigel Thornberry. Yeah. You cannot take it seriously. And they added, like, so much reverb to his voice. Like, and you're like, I'm not sold on this.
You're
showing up for the express purpose of being defeated.
Yeah.
Let's not kid ourselves. So.
Yeah, and the CGI was also shaky. There was some poor rendering. Because I think it got to the point where, like, the entire thing was CGI. It felt like a Zack Snyder finale. And I'm not saying, again, I defend Zack Snyder. I think he's a much better, like, a lot of people think he's the Antichrist. I don't think so. I think he's a good director who's just kind of misguided at times. But given how incredibly Patty Jenkins directed the rest of the movie,
right,
I feel like there was either studio stepping in or other people stepped in to do the, not necessarily to, like, take over, but, like, to give her direction on the finale.
Yeah, I mean, it was just sort of meat for the lions. Like,
yeah.
Most people are sold on superhero movies because they want to see, you know, stuff blow up, and they want to see some reasonably neatly choreographed action.
Yeah.
And so that had happened a little bit when she was fighting other human beings.
And the Amazonian scene on the beach. That action was incredibly
cool. That was cool. That was cool.
Yeah.
But it was made all the more interesting by the fact that they got in large part torn to shreds. They only won by virtue of having more people. That scene was good. The scene when she's crossing No Man's Land is good. It's only when I think it felt like all the other superhero movies, like you said, that the action started to feel kind of cheap.
Yeah. And that was going to be my next question. Did you have any particular favorite scenes in the movie? Any standouts? Because the No Man's Land sequence has pretty much been universally praised. And I also think that the Amazonian, the fight on the beach is pretty great, just because Robin Wright kicking ass. Like, the scene when she jumps off the shield and shoots
three arrows.
I don't care if you like the movie or not. You have to admit that is a badass moment. That is a great moment. So my only other problem with the movie, besides the thematically shaky finale, is Robin Wright's character and her death. Because I understand that in order for the plot to move forward, they kind of had to rush through it. Like, because what happens is Robin Wright's character gets shot. There's, like, a 30-second exchange between her and Diana where she's like, Diana, you must go, you must go. And then she dies. And then all of a sudden, the Amazonians go after Steve. And then Diana pops up and defends Steve. And then they never mention it again for the rest of the movie.
Right.
So I feel like that was the only part that was glossed over. And you didn't really feel the full weight of how that impacted Diana.
Right. Of course, you don't feel the full weight despite seemingly half an hour having been spent on creating the backstory of this relationship.
And also
the fact that you time wasted.
Yeah, and you cast Robin Wright as her. So that was the only other part of the movie I didn't care. I thought that wasn't
good. Yeah, I thought that was a matter of pacing, not so much with concept.
Because you had, in order for the movie to move on, you had to immediately, it also makes sense that the moment that she dies, the Amazons would immediately turn on Steve because he's the last man there and they assume that he's with the Germans.
Right.
So it made sense narratively. It just, I think for the character, could have been dwelled on a bit more.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that was my favorite scene though.
That was like my only other. My favorite scene was actually the snow, when the snow starts falling. When I love the scene right after they save the town, and it's just Diana and Steve together.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that's a genuinely beautiful scene.
I thought that was very pretty. I thought that was breathtakingly sincere.
Yeah. And it also felt like the movie was stopping and giving characters time to develop.
Yeah.
And that's what I think. Yeah. I think a lot of the issue with the other three DCEU movies is that every scene sort of moves, this is going to be an interesting criticism. Every scene moves the plot along. And it feels like every scene, they're like, now this has to happen. Now this has to happen. Now this, because at least like Batman v Superman has a very convoluted plot that there are a lot of moving parts. Sure. And Man of Steel is very, like, there's a lot of good ideas, but it's kind of choppily edited, and it's kind of a mess because it's not a linear story. It's jumping around.
Yeah.
Because it's flashing back to Clark's
life. I think I know what you're saying. I don't think it's so much that, but rather that in most other movies, every scene is designed to ratchet up the tension, building up towards the climactic battle. And that wasn't the case here.
Yeah. Like, it didn't... I mean, it advanced the plot in that it advanced the relationship between...
Right.
Which is the movie.
Right.
So, I guess that is an odd criticism to make, but it felt like a character-building moment in a cinematic universe devoid of those types of quiet character-building moments.
Right. Yeah,
so that's why I love that scene.
I thought that was a good scene. I got echoes of Midnight in Paris in that scene. It was set in Belgium, I believe. So, a Francophone vibe, I guess you could say. And again, there was just a loveliness and a sincerity to it that was pretty compelling.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I was pretty taken by the London scenes. Again, the core of the movie is about these human relationships, not about the action. And so the things in London did a whole lot to advance those relationships.
Yeah.
And, you know, despite my beef with, you know, the sidestepping that was part and parcel of Diana being a fish out of water in London, that was where the movie, I think, was its most intellectual and political. And, that's, I guess, what I want more out of
a
movie.
Yeah. And I completely understand that. And I loved the whole sincerity. Like, I loved the moment where Diana gets the ice cream and she eats it and she goes to the ice cream vendor and she's like, you should be so proud.
Yeah.
And I love Steve's reaction because he laughs, but... And I think this is part of, like, Chris Pine's performance, is he laughs, but it's not like
He's not laughing at her.
It's like, you are this, like, you are incredible. He's laughing in, like, sort of disbelief at how incredible
right.
she is.
Right.
And it just, like, it was a very human movie. And I think that is what the movie does best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you feel about Chris Pine's merry band of male helpers?
So, I mean, people are comparing them to the Howling Commandos from Captain America the First Avenger. And I already knew that I liked the characters in Wonder Woman better because I'd forgotten that there were actually other characters in Captain America the First Avenger besides Captain America and Agent Carter. Peggy Carter, I think.
What's her
name? I forgot. I think her first name's Peggy. That just shows how memorable that I know Agent Carter because of the TV show that came afterwards.
Sure.
I never actually watched it, but I heard it was quite good. I thought that they were kind of, like, the movie hinted at backstories for all of them, but obviously didn't have the time to go into them. And they all, like, the thing is, they're all different, like, sort of ethnic stereotypes. But at the same time, they did feel like actual, like, I really thought that the scene when she's talking to Chief, the Indian scout, and Chief is like, well, my people were destroyed or their land was taken. And
right.
she's like, by whom? And he's like, his people, and he gestures to Steve.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and then the sniper, I think his name's Charlie, the character Ewan Bremmer plays.
Right.
He has PTSD. Again, there's no real arc. It's just kind of their characteristic is that, you know, it's kind of one note. But at the same time, they felt like human beings. Like, they felt like actual people.
They did feel human. I'm not opposed to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there are political issues with the fact that they were caricatures. But at the same time, they were very human, very flawed. They all served obvious and meaningful purposes.
Yeah.
Again, you know, it was kind of cool to see, like, you know, a bunch of strong, strapping men huddled behind Diana because
yeah.
they recognized that, you know, she was the super one, not them. So, yeah, I thought they were a positive addition. I don't know if we'll remember them in a couple years' time.
Yeah. You know, they didn't ruin the movie. Like, they only added to the movie.
Right.
They didn't subtract anything. I thought that the French guy who wanted to be an actor, they got a couple of laughs out of him, and I thought he did a perfectly good
job. The Egyptian?
Was he Egyptian?
The vaguely Ottoman character.
Okay. He sounded like he had a French accent, unless I completely... Because he and Diana speak French at one point.
He might have been Algerian.
He also says voila a lot.
Yeah. It might have been Algerian and Moroccan again.
Anyway, like, the guy who's like vaguely foreign.
Arabic.
Yeah, I thought he was... I mean, they're all perfectly serviceable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, the comparisons to Captain America, the First Avenger, I thought that the movie drew a lot more from Superman. Have you seen the original Superman with Christopher Reeve?
I saw Man of Steel.
Man of Steel. Okay. So, this was sort of the movie that Man of Steel probably should have been, mm-hmm. because it draws a lot. First off, the alleyway scene, which I loved, where Diana and Steve back down an alley, and then these four German agents surround them, and then they shoot at Steve, but Diana blocks the bullet with her bracelet,
right?
And then she beats them all up. It's a great scene, and it's also a really good subversion, I guess, of the... Because there's a very famous scene in the original Superman where Lois Lane, I believe Lois Lane, who's played by Margot Kidder, is being mugged, or, I don't know, something's happening with her where a guy's pointing a gun at her in an alley, and Clark Kent runs down, and then he shoots at Lois Lane, but Clark Kent blocks it with his hand, and he hides the bullet from her because he's trying to keep his secret identity.
Yeah.
That obviously isn't a problem with Wonder Woman. But I really liked how the roles were reversed, where Steve is getting shot at, Diana blocks it, and then Diana beats them all up. I thought that was a nice callback to Superman in a movie that didn't necessarily borrow story-wise from Superman, but I thought thematically borrowed a lot from the Richard Donner Superman.
Yeah, yeah. I get that. I'm not sure how related these two points are, but that scene did remind me a fair bit of Robert Downey Jr.'s Sherlock in the way it was filmed.
Yeah, the it definitely had a similar feeling.
In though, the obvious setting.
The London.
Industrial London.
Yeah.
But it might be worth noting that it's also in industrial London where Wonder Woman, I think, becomes most similar to the real-life woman who she is allegedly modeled after, which is Margaret Sanger, who I just read this today.
Okay.
In, of all places, the New York Review of Books.
Interesting.
Which I appreciate is a horrible thing for me to say. So Wonder Woman was invented by this guy, William Marston or something.
William Moulton Marston.
William Moulton Marston. Marston.
Yeah, I think William
Interesting Moulton guy.
Yeah, a little crazy.
The salient point is that he was polyamorous.
Yeah.
So he had a wife and a lover named Olive. And Olive was the niece of Margaret Sanger. Margaret Sanger is the founder of Planned Parenthood.
Okay, I didn't know that part.
She is this sort of industrial urban crusader for sexual equality, for access to contraceptive care and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, she's a woman who is very much a lion in the urban jungle. And so I saw a little bit of that in London.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
That was cool. I'm not sure if I was reading that into the movie, but I felt winked at a little bit.
Yeah. And I had read about William Moulton Marston, the guy who created, he's a very interesting person. I won't go into his personal habits or beliefs. I recommend that you, dear listener, if you're still with us, should go into that. But yeah,
well,
I can also wink at his
you know, BDSM peccadilloes, you could say. I mean, Diana ties people up. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is that Wonder Woman was originally created to show, you know, to indicate to women, like, the lasso. Like, so in the early issues, in the early comics, Wonder Woman gets tied up a lot.
But she,
like, an excessive amount, and it was supposed to show William Moulton Marston, I'll never pronounce his name regularly, I would give a different way every time. He was supposed to show them that, you know, he was supposed to show women that you could be submissive and it'd be a good thing.
Or
so
you,
it's very questionable.
Or you can be dominant. I mean,
yeah.
The piece I read suggested that he ultimately believed that it was men who were supposed to be submissive.
Yeah, he believed that, like, in 500 years or something, that there would be a war of the sexes and that women would eventually win the war.
Right, and that's ultimately why Diana has the lasso.
Yes. So,
and
yeah.
And, you know, there's one scene where Chris Pine willingly ties it around himself.
Almost, yeah, because he wants to tell
almost hurriedly. You know, he's like, "Oh, buy me." You know, it's so
I don't think that's where the movie was going. He does that to show Diana how sincere he is and how genuine he is and the fact that he's telling the truth. I did not get that at all from that scene.
And he has to submit himself to her in order to do so.
That's, he does it willingly.
Yeah, that's the point.
All right, well, all right. I did not get that at all. You can have whatever. You know what?
I'm just saying whatever. There's a sexual politics to this that I cannot claim to fully understand. But it's there. It's definitely linked yeah. at.
And I do want to say that the sex scene in this movie is handled really well.
Yes.
There's nothing... It, again, this practically feels cliche at this point, but it feels sincere and genuine. And, you know, Dan and Steve kiss, and then it cuts away just to the outside. It's a very beautiful shot yeah, with a snowfall.
It doesn't ogle.
Like, does not ogle. It does not leer.
No.
It felt very proper and good for the movie. And respectful. It was very
yeah,
respectful.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was arguably... flawed in the same way that the movie had these two idealistic ideas about love. Like, you know, it was a very PG kind of romance, which is in stark contrast to maybe the more gritty sexual realities of the Wonder Woman tradition.
Yeah. But I don't think they were going to make a widely successful blockbuster.
No. And that's things. Precisely the point is yeah. that the movie could afford to be subtle, to be a little subversive, but it was so important that it succeeded, and so it had to play yeah. a little safe.
So I guess as a good wrap-up, we'll talk about Wonder Woman and beyond, what this movie means yeah. for the DC Extended Universe, what it means for Hollywood in general. So I heard something very interesting. It was saying that pretty much the whole line of thinking about, you know, this movie had to do well because it was directed by a female director, and if the movie doesn't do well, we will never make another movie directed by a female again. And the critique of that was pretty much saying that we should be at a point where female directors can make movies that don't do well.
Yes.
And then we can still let them make movies. Because, you know, it's not like we stop seeing, you know, movies directed by male directors just because they don't do well. I mean, yes, there are male directors who are bad directors and, you know, make bombs and then they disappear. Right. But the whole idea was, like, movies like Jurassic World and Godzilla, they took male directors who had made one indie movie. Gareth Edwards for Godzilla and Colin Trevorrow.
Gareth Edwards did what movie?
Gareth Edwards did Monsters.
He did the World of Warcraft movie, did he not?
No, that was
no, that was
Duncan
Jones.
Moon,
who did
yeah,
Moon.
Duncan Jones, God, the son of
that was
David Bowie. I think
appalling.
I forget it was, yeah, I never actually saw that. But
lasted 10 minutes.
Oh God. Anywho's. So pretty much the whole criticism was that Hollywood would be more trusting of a male director who had done one indie movie and give them a huge budget, you know, this massive budget, this huge franchise movie. Whereas with female directors, like, no one was saying before Godzilla, before Jurassic World, like, if this movie doesn't do well, the world's over. But with Wonder Woman, it was saying, you know, if this movie doesn't do well. Which I do understand, but I also think that's, like, a reality. That's unfortunately the sad state of Hollywood, is that this movie, I think, it's great that it did well, and I don't really know what the hypothetical conversation would be if we were sitting here talking about how bad it was and how badly it's doing. I don't know what that conversation would
be. I mean,
look like.
I think it deserves mention that Patty Jenkins is just like Gareth Edwards or Duncan Jones or Hines, whatever it is.
Duncan Jones. Yeah.
In that she did one good...
She did Monster also. Movie. Monster in 2003.
Right.
And then she directed a couple TV episodes.
And then she somehow was given this assignment. And then
yeah.
So she was as much of an unknown quantity as these male directors were.
And
she was she's given a similar opportunity, which is good. I'm happy that's the case. I wish it was the case a little more often. But I think it had to succeed, particularly because it was in the superhero genre, right? And more so than most other genres or subgenres, that's just like a genre rife with chauvinism. And so there's a lot of work to be done there.
Yeah.
And so it would have been super disappointing if that was a kind of wall or something, what have you, that couldn't be broken down.
Yeah. And I mean, the movie is extremely well directed. It's visually really well done.
Yeah, and I read somewhere that they were going for a John Singer Sargent.
Interesting.
Sort of sort of vibe. He's an American landscape and portraiture painter.
Hmm. Well, like Themyscira, all of the shots in Themyscira, they're more colorful than any other DCEU movie, and certainly more visually stunning than any Marvel movie. Because Marvel movies, I mean, you could probably do a whole podcast about them, but, you know, they're very much assembly line-like, where they're good, they're very solid, but nothing spectacular. And visually very, with a few exceptions, with probably the only exception being the Guardians of the Galaxy is a visually interesting movie.
Yeah.
They're visually very bland.
Yes.
And this movie was, I loved the Themyscira shots, and also I thought No Man's Land, it was a gorgeous-looking scene. Like, really, some very striking imagery. Like, yes, I love that first establishing shot where you see the two lines and there just flashes on both sides. Like, it's a bird's eye view.
I mean, again, it's the best World War One movie probably ever made.
No, I want to talk about the cinematography.
But the cinematography is what made it so good.
Yeah. No, and
because it looked awful down there. It looked awful in No Man's
Land. It was very, And yet somehow, I will say this, somehow Diana's hair remains perfect throughout. Which is, like, it's kind of distracting.
She is kind of distractively beautiful
at times in this movie. So I think we've gone on long enough about this movie. Do you have any closing thoughts? Anything you want to sneak in at the end that you haven't been able to say so far? Or do you want to reinforce anything you've said?
I mean, I would encourage everyone to shell out the $10 to see the movie, first and foremost. And I guess I would just say in conclusion that it's worthwhile to do a little reading on the context of the movie and the stakes of the movie before you watch it. But that ultimately what makes this movie so good is that it's just plain and simple a good superhero movie, and there haven't been enough of those in recent history.
Yes. It feels very fresh. It feels very, it's a very sincere movie, and I think that's its biggest strength. And it knows, this is the type of movie that knows exactly what it is, and it is that. Like, it doesn't try to do anything, maybe the ending kind of, but, like, it doesn't try to do anything more than tell a very compelling story about Diana Prince and show how she became Wonder Woman and her experiences that got her to that point.
Right.
And I, like, yes, there are problems throughout, and certainly I'm sure there are nitpicks. It's not perfect. It's far from perfect, but, you know, what movie is.
But it belongs in a pantheon of good superhero movies, of which there have been few good entrants lately.
I mean,
Dark Knight, arguably Captain America, arguably some of the Iron Mans.
I would say the Dark Knight, probably The Dark Knight, Iron Man 1, Guardians of the Galaxy, Wonder Woman, and the original Superman, maybe, and one of the, probably Spider-Man 2. Those are the movies, and Logan. This is the problem, is like, there's always one you forget about.
Yeah.
But absolutely go see this movie. It's the type of movie that does so much right that you won't care about what it does wrong.
Yeah, it's a movie. It's a good movie. You'll have a good time.
Yes. Damn it, I wanted that to be the last line, because that... In short, see this movie. It's incredible. So thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to the rest of The Voice's podcast, The Voice Podcast Network. You can follow The Voice on Twitter at @GTownVoice. You can follow Halftime on Twitter and @HalftimeGU. You can follow Noah on Twitter at
Noah Bion.
Oh, for so difficult.
Yeah. You can follow Graham on Twitter at something G Pibbles.
It's at G Piro 22. I didn't remember that.
Did you have something far more juvenile at first?
At first I had at Graham Crackers 22.
Okay.
But I changed that.
Was it Crackers with a Z?
No. But it was Graham as G-R-A-M. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe and go see Wonder Woman.
Yeah, it's been real. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.